Coming up, we got Kenny Beecham talking about our league pass darlings across the NBA. And then we got John Daigle later in the show talking fantasy football. That's all coming up right now. All right, let's talk some basketball. Joining me, the one and only Kenny Beecham. Kenny, how you doing today?
Doing great. Excited to talk again. The last time we did an episode together was about 5 years ago, so it's a long time coming to be back with you.
Was it that long ago? 5 years already? Middle of the pandemic we did a show?
We were talking about Larry Markkanen and the Bulls, and you know, that was a long time ago, man.
Oh my God. I mean, today we're going to be talking about League Pass darlings. These are the teams and the players and X's and O's, whatever it is we want to talk about, that we're most excited to watch this season. So, Kenny, I want you to start us off. What's your first League Pass darling?
My first League Pass darling is the hype that I have for the 2025 NBA draft. I'm always a guy that's really excited about the new up-and-coming talent. And then last year for the 2024 draft, I got a month into the season, and I recognize a lot of the stuff that people are writing about the 2024 class is kind of true. You know, these guys can be contributors. We saw like Jalen Wells be a contributor very early on and so on, but maybe not the ceiling of some future or previous draft class. And now I look at 2025 between Cooper, between Harper, between VJ and Khan and Ace and Trey Johns. We go on and on about like the new talent that's coming into the league and how excited I am to watch, because not only are they in this league and could do cool things, a lot of them went to situations that's just different. We're so used to the top four picks going to teams that are not very good. And then this year, between Dallas jumping up, the Spurs jumping up, Philly jumping up, a lot of the guys that got drafted very early on are in very particular situations on teams that are trying to compete. So I'm just excited to see how these younger guys can really contribute. And as we continue to see the way the league is evolving, and team building is evolving, having young contributing guys on rookie scale contracts becomes exponentially more important for teams that are trying to win. So I'm really excited to see, can Cooper Flagg be great immediately? Can Dylan Harper make that logjam of guard positions easier because he's going to be so good, and so on and so forth.
I mean, I think Cooper so far in preseason, and of course Dylan Harper in his debut for the Spurs, but Cooper especially, like, he didn't look like a rookie. He looks like a veteran out there with the moves. And I think with Cooper, last year entering his freshman season at Duke, the question was with him was, well, he does everything, but can he shoot? Well, he shot the hell out of the ball at Duke last season, mostly on spot ups from three. He could hit some pull-ups as well. But then still entering the NBA, the main question with him is going to be, well, what's he going to look like as an on-ball guy? It's just a preseason sample, Kenny, but like, he looks to me as a player that spent this offseason working on his ability off the dribble. And he looks like a more advanced version of himself entering this rookie season with the Dallas Mavericks. And so, like, with him in a winning situation, Harper on a Spurs team trying to take a leap, VJ Edgecombe, very, very critical to the Sixers as an X factor on that team. And then you get to the bad teams like Con Knipple and Ace Bailey and Trey Johnson and all of these guys. Like, I think this year's rookie class, like, even aside from the top 10, there's just a lot of, I think, fun players. Like, you have Heat fans super excited about Kasparis Jakachonis. It just goes deep in the first round this year.
Yeah, no, I got to watch a lot of him being an Illinois boy here. And the fact that he ended up at 20 was really surprising. I remember throughout the season, a lot of the mocks had him. I saw him as high as like 5 at one point during last year's college season.
Pre-injury, obviously, right?
Pre-injury, exactly. Yep. Obviously, he got injured and it kind of tanked his stock a little bit. But him ending up at 20, listen, I'm all about overreacting to preseason games and stuff. And in one of his two preseason games, he looked like Magic Johnson at sometimes. So it's like, I can understand if I'm a Heat fan, you need something to be really hype about. So him and Kalel wearing Bam Adebayo sounds kind of good. Jan Hansen, first preseason game, didn't look great. Second one, looked like a baby Jokic. So I think it's completely okay for fans to watch these four preseason games and get hyped for the season, even if a lot of the guys won't materialize to what you saw in preseason.
No, exactly. I mean, I think it's okay to feel excited. You want to feel excited as a fan. And I think a lot of the rookies this year will make you feel that way. Let's move to my first one here. Jalen Johnson and the Atlanta Hawks. I think Jalen Johnson is going to be one of the guys this year that really becomes a bigger name. I thought last year, prior to his injury, he arguably should have been an all-star, at least in the bubble. And this year, the way the Hawks are playing in preseason with motion and movement, they're putting the ball into Jalen Johnson's hands as a guy who can initiate offense. They're doing it with Dyson Daniels. Trey is playing off the ball more often. I just think this is the vision of their head coach, Quinn Snyder. This is what Quinn Snyder wants. And for Jalen Johnson in particular, at his size, 6'9", with length and versatility, like, there's sometimes when you watch Jalen Johnson highlights, Kenny, and you squint your eyes and it's like, it looks like LeBron James. Just the movement and the size and the fluidity. I mean, this picture on screen right now with the dunk, it's like the dude just sometimes looks like LeBron light. And it feels like the Hawks are going to be putting the ball in his hands to do a lot of different versatile things this season. So I think Jalen Johnson is one of the players that I'm most excited to watch this season. And I also think there's a real strong probability he could end up having an all-star year too.
Yeah, I remember about halfway through the season before his injury, there was real conversations on Hawks Twitter on like, who's our best player this year? And Jalen Johnson got a good amount of those votes. That's how good and dynamic he was. And with an entire offseason where, you know, dealing with his injuries and stuff, he was still able to work out quite a bit. I'm really excited about what he could be. I loved him last year as a ball handler during pick and rolls, as a roll man, as a shortcut passer. He kind of put a lot of things together. There are certain things like off the bounce in the half court that really I'm intrigued to see if he takes another step there. But I don't know. I think what scares me a little bit is that we all love Atlanta this season, right? There's got to be something there if 99% of people that talk sports is like Atlanta's the third best team, the fourth best team in the conference. It scares me also knowing the Atlanta Hawks have been a playing team for like a decade straight, it feels like. But if there's any time to be hype, it's right now. Jalen Johnson is an absolute stud, one of our premier, you know, transition players in the league. Like, if he gets a head of steam, you better watch out because he's going for your head. And a really, really fun watch.
Yeah, man. I think with Atlanta, I think on one hand, you can see, you know, Jalen Johnson wrap around passes to Okongwu hitting the corner three in preseason. And you can see Risa Shea and Daniels on defense and see them locking down and see all the size and length around Trae Young. On one hand, you can say that. But I think if you are poking holes to your point, you would say, A, well, the health of Kristaps Porzingis, is he going to be able to be KP? And if he is KP, is he going to be able to sustain that when we've seen him suffer so many injuries over the full duration of his entire career? And the second thing is the weak link Trey? Is it Trey with him on defense? Is he going to be the point of attack? Is his offensive brilliance going to be diminished off on that end of the floor if other guys are handling the ball and he's forced into, you know, being off-screen guy or spot up guy? I personally think this is the dream version of Trae Young. This is the version of Trey that I have long wanted to see, and we'll see if how he performs in that. But ultimately, Kenny, I think if you are poking holes, like, those are the things that potentially you could look at. Like, KP health is an obvious one, but Trae Young, how does he fulfill this role is going to be, I think, the main one. When the rest of the roster, to me, looks pretty complete. Like, how does Trae Young perform within that ecosystem?
Yeah, we're going to learn a lot more about Trae Young as a ball player this season. By all accounts, he seems really excited about being with Quinn Snyder and the system that he's been able to run over the last year or some change. And that playing off the ball thing is always what we think about for Trae Young, because he's been a guy for as long as we've known him, from high school to college, where the ball has been in his hands 99% of the time he's been on the court. And as we saw last year, you know, like you mentioned, playing a little bit off ball more, letting Dyson create, initiate offense, and letting Jalen do it. This is the complete year of buying in, because we saw him get better defensively. We saw him at least compete more, I guess, is probably the best way to describe Trae Young, because he'll never really be able to be a good defender at his size. But this team, these guys between Dyson, Risa Shea, who, you know, should continue to be a better defender, this is the year we find out a lot about Trae Young. And then that'll let us know if he gets a contract extension or will he be on the market sooner rather than later. But I love everything that's brewing in Atlanta. Should I get to my next one?
Yeah. Let's get to your next one, Kenny.
Okay. I am really, really excited about double bigs not just being back on a few different teams, But Kevin, I count a third of the league has either played double big last season or have talked about during media days about running double big this year. And I'm going to read them out to you. We got the Cavs, who, like, we've seen them play Evan Mobley and Jared Allen for 4 years now, but I'm still going to count it. We got the Hawks, who Quinn Snyder talked about Porzingis and Double O potentially playing together quite a bit. We got the Heat, Khalil Ware and Bam Adebayo, the Knicks, the Karl-Anthony Towns and Mitchell Robinson. That front court might be the reason why I might pick the Knicks to win the Eastern Conference this season. We got the Mavericks, of course, with Anthony Davis and Lively or Gafford. The Nuggets, Jonas Valanciunas and Jokic. Adelman talked about potentially running that together. I cannot wait to really see
it. They played zone defense in their most recent preseason game with those two out there. It's awesome.
Come on, man. This is so fun. The Rockets, you know, their core group of three big fellas, and we saw Şengün and Clint Capela play quite a bit together so far in preseason. The Spurs, Wembanyama and Cornette running pick and roll with Wemby as the ball handler. The Thunder just won a championship with their double big. And lastly, Gobert and our boy Naz Reid. So that's 10. I counted 10 teams that is going to be running some form of a double big this upcoming season. And we just went out of an era where small ball was the thing. Hell, the name of my podcast is Small Ball because it was so much of what we saw between Draymond Green and Iggy and everybody trying to replicate it. And now we're going back to what, like, everything happens in cycles. These big lineups are coming back. And the teams that I did not mention, the 20 teams that I did not mention, may have to catch up because we just watched the Thunder win a championship like that. We just watched the Rockets go to Game 7 with the Warriors, with their offensive rebound and everything. These teams that aren't constructed to have an opportunity to run double big, maybe behind the eight ball.
You know, I think double big, that's a perfect one. To me, like, that is definitely one of the biggest trends in the whole NBA. Like, last year with Houston in the postseason, with Şengün and, of course, with Steven Adams, those two together just pounding the offensive glass. Are we going to see that replicated? Are other teams going to try to attack the offensive glass in order to create more second chances? Because I think he showed something that even with a very limited offense, you can still generate efficient opportunities with that type of lineup that you throw out there. And so I think a lot of these teams across the league, like, I think about the teams that don't really have that card to play, like the Kings, for example. I mean, for them, it's like Domantas Sabonis and that's it. Like, Maxime Reyneau, as a rookie, are you going to play him together? Are you going to play, like, Saric isn't really a true five. Like, it's just Sabonis out there and then a bunch of guards and wings. Like, DeRozan might be your four. And I think, you know, some of these teams, that is a template. To me, lineup flexibility is one of the keys to deep playoff success. Having the ability to play with two bigs, one big, or no bigs. And that's what's so exciting about Denver, too. The fact they now have the best backups of Jokic's entire career, who they might play with him in spurts, but then they can go with, like, Aaron Gordon at the five sometimes if they want to in spurts. Mm-hmm. And so I think all of these teams that are building flexibility is so critical. And you know, I think, Kenny, like, going in cycles is one of the most interesting things about this. I remember, like, you know, the legends, Jonathan Sharks. Like, I remember a long time ago on The Ringer, he wrote an article about how OG Anunoby is the future of the center position in the NBA. Oh, wow. And, like, at the time, it felt like, oh, wow, this actually could be true. Like, PJ Tucker, OG Anunoby, similar body type. But then this wave of bigs just comes into the NBA, and now we're in a position where it's like, well, no. Like, OG might play a small ball five for, you know, 5 minutes once a month, if that. And you know, or maybe once in the entire postseason. It just doesn't happen anymore. And so it is really fascinating, like, how things can happen so unexpectedly. And it makes you kind of wonder, like, where the league is today, what is going to happen that we aren't anticipating in the years to come, you know?
Yeah, I wonder what percentage of the small ball era, if you will, was out of necessity. Obviously, it was a lot out of, like, mimicking the Warriors, who was just the dynasty, but also out of necessity when there wasn't a ton of, like, really diverse bigs. I mean, you think about the names of the players that I just mentioned. A lot of them are diverse bigs who can, you know, either create for others or, like, if they aren't diverse, they're really elite at one thing, like a Steven Adams on the offensive glass. So with us continuing to see so many great bigs enter the league, this might be the way it's going for some time before, again, it reverts back to, oh, maybe speed and athleticism is back to the king across the NBA. But we don't really know. and having the opportunity, like you said, I completely agree with, you know, roster construction is so perfect when you have an opportunity to go no big or go one big or go two bigs. Those are the teams, in my opinion, that have the highest ceiling, like you mentioned, the Denver Nuggets.
Now, the next team I want to talk about here is the Orlando Magic, and they're a team that doesn't really pull that card. But they're different in the sense that, you know, they have Wendell Carter as their five, Goga Bitadze as their backup five, but then they have a bunch of like big wings and forwards, Banchero and Franz Wagner as well, that allow them to play inverted. Now, with the Magic, what I'm excited about with them this season is their other guys. I'm excited about their rookie, Jace Richardson, so far through preseason, they're using him like he's in constant motion without the ball in his hands, constantly moving. He had a play where he inbounded the ball and immediately sprinted right into a dribble handoff for a three-pointer. Like, it's just fun the way they're using Jace Richardson. And then you have Tristan Da Silva, who had a really good rookie season, who had a really good summer as well, playing in Eurobasket for Germany. And he looks like he's going to build on that this season as like a real rock solid 3-and-D guy who can do a bit more off the dribble as well. Really good defensive player. And then you have, kind of just forget about him, Jet Howard, who quietly looks like he could be having a breakout preseason. Again, it's just preseason, but entering year three, it's like, I'm intrigued by Jet Howard. He's averaging 20 minutes a game in preseason. He's shooting the hell out of the ball. He looks very comfortable off the dribble. And I'm just very intrigued by these other guys in the Magic, because so often we talk about Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, the acquisition of Desmond Bane, rightfully so. Jalen Suggs being the dog that he is. But to me, like, they have so many X factors on their team that can help raise the ceiling, and both raise the floor and the ceiling for this Magic roster. That I can't wait to watch this team for the guys that aren't even just the star players.
Yeah, I love the Orlando Magic this season. Obviously, they gave up a lot to bring in Desmond Bane, but he is kind of the perfect fit of everything that they need. The two guys that you mentioned, the younger dudes, the Jason, the Tristan Da Silva, I'm all in on those dudes. And, you know, I think that, you know, what did Jace end up going in this year's draft? Like 25th in this year's draft. And immediately I was thinking to myself after, because we did a little draft show, like, did so many teams overthink this? Because when he was listed at the combine, I think he was like a smooth 6 feet, if that, you know, it was like, oh, is he too small to do this? But in college, he was a, what, 42% three-point shooter, movement shooter, so many things. And when he failed to the Orlando Magic, I was like, oh, that's the perfect spot for him specifically, because if he is just 6 foot in shoes or whatever, they have the infrastructure defensively to hold it and for him to still be a playable player. And that's a team that can desperately use guys that can create or shoot off movement. And that's perfect. Tristan Da Silva in college also shot it very well, right, Kevin? And then he got to the NBA and then he struggled. And I was like, he's probably somewhere in the middle there. And if he's somewhere in the middle there, that's one of the best three-point shooters on the Orlando Magic this season. So I'm really excited. Every time someone comes off one of those Eurobasket or overseas ball for the summer, I'm so high on them. Well, everybody else is catching up and ramping up their conditioning. A guy like Tristan Da Silva has been playing all summer, and he's going to be ready from game number one. A guy that you did not mention that I did an entire segment on, Anthony Black, right? Anthony Black is a guy, you know, that was drafted with 5th, 6th overall in his draft. And I made the point that I think that for his future and maybe for the future of the Orlando Magic, that he should be trying to go on the career path similar to Nikhil Alexander-Walker. I would love to hear your opinions on it. Yeah. More of an off-the-ball guy who in his first season, he shot it well, low volume, yada, yada, yada. In year number two, he struggled. But in the second half of that season, year two of his career, or year – what year are we in? Are we going to year four or are we going into year three?
For Anthony Black? I think year three, yeah, because that was the Jet Howard and Anthony Black draft.
Yes, that's right. Okay, boom. Second half of last season, he shot it really well. So I just feel like, you know, we already know who he is as a defender, right? He's one of the dogs in the NBA alongside pretty much everybody else in his roster. If he can get away from playing on the ball and become more of a spot-up guy, that can just help the Orlando Magic, obviously, especially if Tyus Jones is going to be there too as a backup point guard. So I'm all in on a lot of these younger dudes. You kind of forget that this is still a really young team, right? We all have really good expectations for them, but they are still really, really young.
You know, I had Desmond Bane in my pod a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about some of the players on the roster, and he mentioned how, like, Wendell Carter is going to be the X factor, and he mentioned the chemistry that he has with Paolo Banchero, and he mentioned he loves Anthony Black. And so I think, like, you're right. He is worth mentioning. Is definitely one of those X factors. Like, these, the Magic's just like, they have, like, some of these teams across the NBA, they have really good core pieces and then also really good young cores. Like, I'd say the Magic have one of the 10 best young cores in the NBA and also one of the 10 best veteran cores. And that's not a thing you can say about a lot of teams out there right now. So that's my second one. Kenny, well, what's your third League Pass darling?
Okay, I need you to just let me have this one. Let me put the card on the table. My bias, I'm putting it right up front.
Oh God, the Bulls,
League Pass darling, Chicago Bulls. Talk to me, Kevin. What do you think when you think about League Pass darlings? Teams that are not going to win a ton of games, but are going to be fun to watch. Sure. High pace, good 3-point shooting, great passing, good movement, take over games occasionally, buzzer beaters. You know, we got those between Josh Giddey and Kobe White. I think, like, we all understand that the front office has been really bad over the last 5 years. We all agree there. We don't know where this team is going. But if we're looking at the product as is, it's going to be a fun watch. I like, that's my pitch, is that we're going to be fun to watch and people should tune in.
This is Chance. I mean, I love Manas Vucelis. I love Vucelis. I would love to get rid of Vucevic and Zach Collins.
Yes.
And trade Kobe White for a haul if you're just not going to sign him, which is like, what's going on with Kobe White, Kenny? Do the Bulls want him or not?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I wish I knew.
Strange. Very strange. I feel like he'd be a guy that you'd want to have as a keeper. I think the Bulls are going to be, I think they qualify as a League Pass darling. It's just that maybe I'm focusing too much on those things that still need to change. But ultimately, like, I even really love Ayo Dosunmu. I still really like him. They have a lot of fun players. They are going to play a fun style. Tell me this, you know, maybe this is less important for this season when we're talking about fun. Does this roster have enough shooting for you to feel confident in that core? Like, are the core pieces good enough as shooters for them, like with Vucelis and Giddey and some of these guys? Or is that something that you feel like does need to shift over the course of this next year or two?
Definitely needs to shift. I mean, obviously, on not just on paper, but in actuality, Josh Giddey is a part of the core. You pay a guy $100 million, he has to be. But a lot of times I think about this Bulls team is really the core is Modest. And everything else could go. Like, give Modus the ball and get the hell out of the way is the way I see it. Obviously, me in the front office don't see eye to eye there. But there is a lot of change that needs to come before the Bulls are, like, a, let's just say, a playoff team at the end of the day. I did hear something on the broadcast yesterday during their preseason game that if you took Vucevic off of the roster, this is the youngest team in basketball. And then you look at it and you're like, okay, yeah, 21, 22, 22, 22. Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be true. Now, you can say the same thing about the Wizards. You take Chris Middleton off the roster or CJ McCollum off the roster, then boom, they're the youngest team. But I think it just shows you that even though we disagree with a lot of the things, the one-to-one trades that have happened over the last two seasons, or the drafting, or the, you know, waiting too long to trade a LaVine or DeMar DeRozan, the front office is what it is. But there's still a lot of players with a lot of room for growth here. But nobody on that list is, like, nobody in the world is higher on Modest Buzelis than I am. And I think that's partially because I need to be, right? I need something to hold on to as a Bulls fan. But I think that he continues to show flashes of, like, I don't want to put, like, he can be this guy. But, like, I think he could be a real core piece for the Bulls for the time being. And getting that at 11 is pretty special.
And I think he definitely could go down as one of the biggest steals of the 2024 draft. I'm still surprised he fell all the way to 11. Like, he had a workout with the Atlanta Hawks, who drafted number one. Like, he was in consideration for the number one pick in the draft. And it seemed like a full certainty he'd be going in the top four or five. And so for him to fall all the way to the Chicago Bulls at 11, his home state team, seems like it could be a really good story, like a blessing in disguise for him. And he was great his rookie season, got better every month. And you would expect that he's going to build on it this year. After Vucelis, who were the three players you're most excited about with the Bulls' future?
That is a very good question, because I think Modest is number one S-tier prospect. And then after that, we get to, like, that guy's a C-tier prospect, maybe a D-tier prospect. I guess it has to be Josh Giddey, right? 22 years old at this moment in time. I can't look past the deficiencies, obviously. I think we all can agree that he's very far from a well-rounded NBA player. Hell, even in preseason so far, the Bulls have started off every game losing 16-6, and then Josh Giddey goes to the bench, and then they're back into the game because Ayo Dosunmu has checked in, right? So he's very far away from a guy that you would trust in a postseason series or anything like that. But he probably has to be number two because of the youth. And the things that he does well, he does very well. The things that he does poorly, he does very poorly. So there's big swings between him as a ball player. And then lastly, I mean, I guess we have to put Noah in there, Noah Senge, because we just use a lottery pick on him. Still very raw player. I can't say that I'm completely behind him as a player just yet. It scares me when the number one thing on his scout report is that he draws a lot of fouls in this other league across the sea, across seas. It's like, Are we expecting him to do that in the NBA? So that's a bit weird. And then lastly, I don't know, Kevin. That might be kind of it. But those are the guys we have to count on, man. Listen, my goal is that every time I do a podcast appearance, I get the other host to talk about the Bulls. And we just did it, Kevin. We just talked about the Bulls for 10 minutes, I think.
I mean, look, I think they're going to be fun. I mean, they have a lot of young players to watch. They're not going to be good, though, this year. I hope they trade away some of their vets and get a haul back, because this 2026 NBA draft class, you want a high pick. You want a top three, top four pick. All right, we'll continue this discussion right after this break. Let's move on to my third one here. Anfernee Simons of the Boston Celtics. I cannot wait to see Simons playing Missoula ball all year long. So far in preseason, over 60% of his shot attempts have come from three-point range. His last game on Sunday against the Cavaliers, he looked like Dame. He just did. I mean, it's just the reality of it with the off the dribble stuff he was doing. 6 of 9 from three, step backs, off the catch. Just the dynamic ability that he has as a scorer, we've long known watching him with the Portland Trailblazers. And so I think this year with the Celtics, really as a whole, you know, it's really interesting, Kenny. Like, they're over under the season, I think it's like 45.5. And this is a team that is at least going to play until probably February or March or the whole season without Jason Tatum. But the fact they're over under is still over 500 at 45.5, it, I think, is a testament to some of these players they have on the roster. Anfernee Simons being one of them that can elevate their play to another high level. Peyton Pritchard, of course, as well. It's not just Jaylen Brown. It's not going to be the Jaylen Brown show this year. Derek White could get better too. And so I put the Celtics and Anfernee Simons specifically as a league pass darling for me, because I think even if they end up hovering around 500 all year, they're going to be one of the more fun and interesting teams to watch. And Simons in particular, to me, this is the opportunity of a lifetime for him in this Boston offense. And I can't wait to see what he does there.
Yeah, I think he might be the number one case of a player moving this offseason that people are like, oh, I didn't know he was that good. You know, now that he's playing in Boston and maybe have way more eyes on him compared to when he played for the Portland Trailblazers. So I can see that. Kevin, do you think that he finishes the season with Boston, or do you think that he's potentially moving by February?
I think it depends on their priorities. It's a really good question, because I think with the Celtics this year, if they feel confident that Tatum is going to return in March, let's just say that that's the reality. Let's say he's going to return in March and the Celtics are on pace for 47 wins or whatever, and Tatum's likely to come back. To me, that's going to indicate that Simons is part of the reason why. That Simons is having a great year, along with Peyton Pritchard and Derek White and all these other guys who are stepping up in the absence of Jason Tatum. So in that case, maybe it makes it less likely that Simons were to get traded. However, if it seems probable that Tatum's not going to return, or it's in the team's best interest and in his best interest to not play him for the remainder of the season, Simons could end up being the piece that other teams look at as like, well, we're missing a spark plug scorer in our backcourt. Let's go out and get Anfernee Simons. So I think it's all going to come back to the Tatum question. Is Tatum likely to return or not? And we really won't have the answer to that until January, February. At this point, we do know he wants to come back. Shams Charania said on Pat McAfee last week on his show that Tatum has told the team that he wants to come back this year. We'll see. Ultimately, Kenny, I do think You know, I've said all summer, he's going to do everything in his power to come back. He wants to be like Kobe, but Kobe got hurt 6 games into his return from a torn Achilles when he has suffered another major injury that knocked him out for the remainder of the year. So there needs to be a level of caution here for Tatum and for the Celtics. But ultimately, I think the answer to your Simons question relates to the future of Jason Tatum. And we won't know the answer to that for quite a long time now. Do you think he gets traded?
I can definitely see that. I think that everything you laid out makes perfect sense to me. I asked that as a genuine question because obviously we heard the rumors earlier in the offseason when they acquired him. Like, oh, they're trying to find out if there's another team for him. But he also, on the offensive side, kind of fits Mazzulla Ball to a T, right?
Perfectly.
The guy's always been a really good three-point shooter. I'm looking at it right here. Last year was 36% on 8.5 attempts. The year before that, 38% on 9 attempts. So he's always been a guy that can get him up in bunches and score in bunches. So Definitely can see that. I'm excited. I don't know. This feels so weird to say, and I think it's probably because we don't know much about it. But I can say I'm more excited to watch the Celtics this year than last year coming off a championship. Is that crazy to say?
No, it's not crazy at all. Because it was just a level of sameness with the Celtics last year coming off a title. This year, it's just brand new. It's like you don't really know what to expect. They could be in the lottery. Or they could be in the Eastern Conference Finals. It's like you just don't know. There's so much variance with the Celtics this year, so I'm excited to watch them. Well, what's your next one, Kenny?
My next one is Aaron Gordon, Kevin. I'm really excited to watch Aaron Gordon this season for a few different reasons. Aaron Gordon, I've always had like a love for these glue guys, these guys that like you put them on a team and you watch them turn into a contender, whether they be like a Derek White, a Aaron Gordon, or like really Alex Caruso, really prime examples of this kind of guy. And in all of these offseason / media day quotes really got me hyped for Aaron Gordon. Obviously, we all know the Denver Nuggets made some big time acquisitions between Cam Johnson, between Valanciunas. Even Tim Hardaway Jr., I'm counting as a big acquisition because the bench has always been pretty bad. Brucey Brown, he's back. But here's one of the quotes from Aaron Gordon. I just have to turn it up on defense. We have so much talent on the offensive side. I'm not even worried about that. So I can see, like, a lot of people talk like this, Kevin. I remember a few years ago, D'Angelo Russell said he was going to be Derek White for the Lakers. And it lasted like 2 games before he was not, you know. But when Aaron Gordon says something like this, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I can see him flying around. And a team. This is a team that's going to need to be a better defensive team if they want to win a championship. I can see him being that. And then also, we have the quotes from David Adelman, who talks about him being like Clay. Whatever you really need Aaron Gordon to do, he can do it. We've seen him guard Trae Young. We've seen him guard Luka Doncic. We've seen him guard centers. We've seen him be a post-up player. We've seen him turn into a good three-point shooter. There's so much that Aaron Gordon can provide for this Denver Nuggets team on a day-to-day basis, and he is and has been Mr. Nugget for a reason, but the perfect piece to keep this Nuggets window open as far as championship contention.
I think that's well said about Aaron Gordon, Kenny. And like, he's one of my favorite players in the whole league to watch too. He's just so dynamic. He can just do so many different things for your team. He can be a guy who initiates pick and roll. He can be a guy who he's become an elite shooter. That was his big flaw he had back in Orlando, back when he played in college at Arizona. He was always a shaky shooter. He's become an elite shooter. And he can do stuff off the dribble. He can post up. He can defend any position on defense. Aaron Gordon is just, he fell into a perfect situation with the Nuggets, and he has become the perfect player within that situation. He didn't stop getting better for the Nuggets, and very well, you know, this year he could improve even further. He's looked great off the dribble in preseason for Denver as well. And this kind of ties back to your previous one with the double big lineups with Denver. To me, like, even though they're a contender, like, they're right there with OKC in the Western Conference as one of the favorites, they belong still as a league pass darling. I am just beyond excited to watch the Nuggets this year because I think this team, they have so many different ways that they can play basketball around this Jokic as the center of the solar system. And it's even more extreme than it's ever been. They can play so many different ways. They can play with Gordon at the five. They can play with Valanciunas out there when Jokic is off the bench. They can play through Gordon or have him just be one of the guys. And I don't know. I just think with Denver, man, OKC belongs as the favorite. They're defending champions. They could get even better with all their youth. But ultimately, Kenny, like, you look at this Denver Nuggets roster, and it, like, in a vacuum, it is hard to argue against them, which really just speaks to the greatness of OKC. But we really might have two juggernauts in the Western Conference with OKC and Denver, and then everybody else. And everybody else is really good, but it's very possible it just comes down to these two best teams in the West being on a level of their own. Do you think that's fair to say with OKC and Denver, whereas everybody else suddenly feels less important in the West as deep as it is, if it just becomes these two teams on the level that it seems they are?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's really insane that we just watched one of the youngest teams in the league win 68, and they were going into the offseason like, well, I think I might pick this other team. But that's not a demerit to the Thunder. It's more like the Denver Nuggets were just in seven with them, and they got better. They have the best player in the world. But I could agree that, like, those are the top two teams as contenders in the West, and then everybody else that, like, probably need some injury luck or, you know, be on the right side of the bracket. Hell, maybe OKC and Denver see each other in the second round instead of the conference finals, and now they're beat up come conference finals, and now a certain team can come in and slip in and win the conference because of that. But I think it is these two teams and then the rest, honestly.
My next one here, let's go from one of the best teams to one of the worst teams. The Brooklyn Nets, even their own owner, their own team owner, Joe Tsai, had a strange quote last week where he said, "We have one pick in 2026 and we hope to get a good pick so you can predict what kind of strategy we will use for this season. But we have a very young team." The owner of the team is basically saying, we're gonna tank after having five picks last year, only one pick this year. I'll tell you what, the reason why I have them as a league pass darling, even though this is going to be a tanking team, is because they just have so many fun players. I don't care how much this team is losing. To me, they're going to be a fun team to watch because you have a really good coach and Jody Fernandez, who out of strange response, he kind of covered up for Joe Tsai. He's like, he just wants a good pick because no matter where we pick, our front office is good and they make great picks. But it's true. I mean, it's true. Like, this team, like Danny Wolf, a 7-foot center, Nolan Traore, a speedster point guard, and, you know, got the existing guys on the roster. I really like Nick Claxton as a versatile defender. I really can't wait to see how Noah Clowney develops this year. They have a lot of interesting players across positions, and so I think the Nets belong as a league pass darling this year, Kenny, because of just the amount of youth they have on this team that is fun and weird and exciting to watch. And then there's Cam Thomas, who's just going to shoot every single time he touches the ball. I just can't wait to watch him.
I'm so happy you put him, because Kevin, they are the last team I thought about for this experiment. I think this is going to be a team by December 2nd. I am box score watching Brooklyn Nets games. I'll be honest with you. Let's hope that one of those five rookies really proved me wrong, and then they're the reason to watch. But Joe Tsai, what a crazy quote, but I completely understand him, because if you take five swings one year and none of them work out, and I'm not saying that's still going to be the case, you kind of need that next swing to be the top pick. You can't really afford for Jordy to outcoach the other coaches, and now, you know, they are way better than anticipated. Wow, what a great pick, Kevin.
You're the guy who loves Modest Buzelis and Josh Giddey. I thought you'd have a thing for Yegor Demin.
You're right. When he was mocked there earlier in the season, I was pulling my hair out. We already got Josh Giddey. Why do we need another one? How long before they start running the five guard lineup? We talked about double bigs. How long before we have five point guards on the court? And I'm going to count Danny Wolf. Point guards and Danny Wolf on the court.
He's a point center. He definitely counts. So, like, we're looking at a lineup of Yegor Demin, Danny Wolf, Nolan Traore, Ben Saraf, and who are we missing? We have four right there. Cam Thomas. Cam Thomas as well.
Cam in there.
Yeah, Cam Thomas
in there too. The antithesis of a point guard.
Yes, exactly. So, so those five out there, I mean, Cam Thomas is going to get his buckets, but a lot of touches going on. That's the thing. Like, dude, like, for me, like, league pass darlings, they're not going to be good. At one point in the season, they might suck to watch. But it's just so many different little storylines and threads I can't wait to watch unfold over the course of the year. Like MPJ, as an example, does he get opportunities to develop his game off the dribble, or is he going to be in that off-ball role like we saw him in Denver when there's a lot of guys that deserve touches on this team? do, like some of the veterans become trade targets, like a Terrence Mann type, a Haywood Highsmith, or, you know, guys like that as a piece for contending teams. It's just a weird team with a lot of weird players, and that's why they're on my list, even though I understand that for a lot of people, they're not going to want to watch that group at all. What's your next one, Kenny? This is your fifth one,
my next one. Putting all jokes aside, I there are some, like you mentioned, really intriguing stuff. Nicholas Claxton is one guy that I really like in the NBA, and last year it wasn't exactly what I anticipated his progression line to be like, so I'm excited to see if he can get back to, you know, at one point I was looking at him as like, man, he's one of the most versatile five-man defensively in the league. And
The best switch defenders in the league when he's playing at his best. One of the best. Exactly. But last year, the dip made him unappealing to other teams. Like, he's going to restore his value this year, not just for the Nets, but for, like, the other 29 teams that might see in him a centerpiece on the roster. And thus far, we'll see. It's going to be a bounce back year for him.
Yeah. At his peak, I feel like we talk about the double big thing. He could be a guy that can fit into a double big lineup because of that defensive versatility. Mm-hmm. All right, I'll give you my last one. This team is on a similar tier than the Brooklyn Nets, so I can't laugh at your Brooklyn Nets pick. The Charlotte Hornets could be a fun basketball team, right? If he can count for solid health. Right? Just solid health, not the best health. I don't need 82 games for LaMelo. I don't need 82 games from Brandon Miller. But I am intrigued with this team. I do think that it's going to be hard for them to put together a competent defense given the pieces that are on their team and all. But as far as like another really fun team, you know, Charles Lee coming from where he comes from when he was an assistant. His team last year jacked up a lot of three-pointers. Brandon Miller kind of eliminated the in-between game that we saw him have in college in his first year of his NBA and turned those into three-point shots. And though he didn't shoot it very efficiently last year, he's a guy that, like, I will put $1 million on the fact that he's going to be a plus three-point shooter for the entirety of his career. He's just too silky smooth from behind the arc. And, you know, they have athletes. You know, I can see Diabate getting 12 offensive boards and a half one time this season. So there's some really intriguing stuff. And then we talked about the rookies, Con Knipple. I feel like he kind of puts a lot of these things together. So I'm intrigued. You know, I bought a lot of Charlotte Hornets stock last year trying to predict them to do what the Pistons ended up doing. Obviously, I was so wrong and I won't buy into that level again. But there are some really intriguing stuff. And I think that LaMelo has been, you know, And some realm of NBA Twitter super overrated, but also another realm super underrated. And I kind of steer more to like slightly underrated as far as being this jumbo playmaker. I still think he cannot hold water on the defensive side, and that's the next point of his progression. But I could see myself loading in on a, you know, 6 o'clock game because they have the first one and watching the entire first half of every game of their season before I switch on to some other game.
With this team, I agree with everything you said. To me, like, they're on the list as well. I'm very excited to watch the Hornets this year, and like, that's even LaMelo aside. Like, even just putting aside how fun LaMelo is to watch, it's almost all of these other guys that are intriguing the most. Like, I know what to expect of LaMelo, but with, like, does Brandon Miller take a leap? No. How does Con Knipple look as a rookie? Ryan Kalkbrenner, their second round rookie center from Creighton, does he become the guy for this team? Does he become like the next Brook Lopez at 7'1", massive frame, can shoot deep threes, you know, without any movement at all? There's just an interesting group of young players on the Hornets with a really good coach as well, and Charles Lee. To me, with this team, Kenny, the big question with them is still, can LaMelo Ball stay healthy, and can LaMelo Ball play winning basketball? How important is that to you when it comes to the fun factor in watching the Hornets? And also, do you believe LaMelo has that in him to play winning basketball for the Charlotte Hornets?
Yeah, LaMelo is such a unique case. Like, every step of his basketball playing career, he's had the longest leash. He might have had the longest leash of every ball player ever between, you know, playing at Chino Hills to playing overseas and now going to Charlotte, who before this previous regime, they didn't really know what the hell they were doing. So go out there, let them hoop. But I think in order for them to hit the fun factor that I'm expecting them to hit and for them to be a competent NBA team, we do need LaMelo to reel it in just a little bit and kind of recognize some of the structure that goes into what it takes to become a competent NBA team. And I think that, you know, their offseason was really good, all things considered. I mean, probably the best offseason the Charlotte Hornets have had in 10 years, you know, between their draft and then some of these smaller pickups like trading Yusuf Nurkic for Colin Sexton. Colin Sexton is a real ball player, right? Spencer Dinwiddie is a real vet that's been around the league for a decade plus. Some of these things will help, you know, mold this team into a real competent professional team. And again, I'm a guy that likes to stay really positive. These offseason videos that I'm seeing from them makes me really hyped. The fact that the guys have been together, not just through training camp, but also been hanging out outside of that or before that. And, you know, when the rookies come in to sign their deal, the entire team is there in the practice facility cheering them on. That type of stuff cannot be understated, in my personal opinion. So LaMelo does need to reel it in just a little bit, but also that long leash is one of the reasons why he can be really fun. Mm-hmm. But you gotta balance it. And he has not been able to do that yet.
Yeah, I think in a way, like with LaMelo, we've seen him play with multi-ball handler systems in the past, both really throughout his life, playing with his brothers. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we know he has a willingness to do things off the ball. And to me, I think one of the real keys to that growth for LaMelo is these other guys becoming that guy who's worthy of having the ball in their hands at a high level. And, you know, Con Knipple, they draft him in the lottery this year. He's going to be a great shooter. What does he become off the dribble is going to be a big element of that. And Brandon Miller, who you mentioned, his kind of evolving shot diet, you know, with a new head coach last year, he went from taking a 40% of his shots from three to 56% of his shots from three. He toned down the mid-range jumpers. And that's one of the things with Miller that I think it's fascinating, because he's such an adaptable player. And at the high school level, he was a mid-range heavy guy. And then he went to Alabama playing for Nate Oates there. And they played a very, you know, analytically driven style where they took like five mid-range jumpers the whole year. They didn't take mid-range jumpers at all. It was even more extreme than like NBA teams take it. And Brandon Miller did not take mid-range jumpers. And some people use that as a critique of him while he's forcing certain shots. Well, it's like, no, in high school, this is where he lived. And then NBA, we've seen him play two different ways. And with Brandon Miller, I really do think, regardless of how he's playing, whether he's involving the mid-range or not, he has shown a level of adaptability going back to the high school and college level that makes me feel like he can thrive with any player, any style, any system. It's just about the talent catching up and becoming a reality with him. And to me, this is really one of the key things with Charlotte this year. And I have real belief in Brandon Miller, Kenny, that this guy's going to be a star. It's just a matter of when, not if. I'd say with Brandon Miller that at some point this dude is going to be an all-star caliber player and maybe even all NBA caliber player at some point in his career. Dude's a baller, man. Like he's an absolute dog out there. Genuinely loves basketball. And one of the reasons why I'm very bullish on the Hornets' future, it's almost more about Brandon Miller than it is about, you know, LaMelo Ball for me. LaMelo is more he needs, you know, hopefully he figures it out because he really raises their ceiling. But if he doesn't, well, he's a trade piece, and you still have a lot else to be excited about in Charlotte, even aside from LaMelo Ball.
Yeah, that's completely fair. Like, I could see two different futures. I could see a future with LaMelo and without LaMelo, and I think both of those futures I can find myself being optimistic about. So I agree. I think I'm agreeing with you with Brandon Miller being an absolute stud. I can't wait to see him back on the court because we didn't really get much of him last season. So him being healthy and ready to ball out, cannot be more excited for.
I think what you just said summarizes my next team, the last one here, a team that is exciting with or without the current face of the franchise, the New Orleans Pelicans. Zion Williamson obviously dropped a ton of weight this summer, looks great, and all eyes are going to be on Zion this year, and I can't wait to watch Zion. Like, it's very possible we see peak Zion Williamson this year for the Pelicans, and that very well could change the way in which the team performs. But last year, they had a lot of injuries. I mean, Trey Murphy was out. Herb Jones missed a ton of time. And so you get those two guys back in addition to a reshaped roster with some fun young rookies. I can't wait to watch Derek Queen. Last year at Maryland, had a really good year. Of course, we saw him hit the game-winning runner in the tournament in the Sweet 16. Jeremiah Fears out of Oklahoma, a dynamic shot-creating guard who was super, super clutch last year. I mean, for NBA fans who don't really follow college basketball at all, with like Jeremiah Fears, the last name, he really, like, no fear is a thing with him. Like, the dude is not afraid of big moments and games. And so I think with this Pelicans team, they have a lot of players that I like, young players I'm excited to watch. And then they have like the fun, like Jordan Poole, go to work, man. Like, take a ton of shots. I look forward to seeing the way this Pelicans team performs. And in some ways, Kenny, I think with New Orleans, they're definitely projected to miss the playoffs considering how strong the Western Conference is. But I do think it's worth thinking about how good this team was when Zion was healthy just a few years ago. I mean, this was a team that was in the playoffs. They did win 49 games. I think there's an outside shot the Pelicans end up being in the playoffs in the Western Conference, regardless of how deep it is, because there's always surprises every single year in the NBA. And if you get 70 games out of Zion Williamson, 75 games, which you can't rule it out, this team, maybe they end up way better than anybody anticipates. And suddenly, you know, Joe Dumars trading away their pick and their swap, he gets the last laugh.
Yeah. No, when you said Pelicans, that's what my mind went to immediately. That dang on trade that they put off on draft night. Wow. But no, I this might be the best pick of the episode, Kevin. I don't know how I didn't have them. This is a perfect, when you think about the definition of a league pass darling, I don't think it gets much better than the Pelicans' current roster. Between Zion looking different and him playing for something, between Trey Mayfield III, who also always finds a way to be unhealthy, you know, he averaged like 21 points per game last season. That's a huge jump from his previous years. Even the younger guys, between like a Yves Missi, who surprised the heck out of me because I didn't really know much about him going into his rookie season. So this is the definition of that, because they're so – there's such a big range, right? The big range. They could be a team, like you mentioned, that could win 50 if everything goes right, 49 or whatever you mentioned. Or this could be a 30-win team. This could be a 26-win team. You know, it's not that far off either. So trying to figure out exactly where they lie amongst other teams in the Western Conference is the real reason why we watch, right? It is the exact reason why we watch. And Zion is a beast if he's healthy. And I am curious to see, with this new change in way he looks, how much that impacts his overall play style, right? His athleticism, or, you know, the strength that he used to overpower his defenders. Does he lose some of that? Does he become more finesse? I mean, he's already a pretty decent finesse guy too around the rim. So there's so many question marks, and those question marks lead it to them being darlings.
I think that's spot on with Zion, those Zion questions. It's going to be really interesting to see the way he evolves as a player. And I think with any of these guys who lose weight over the summer, and I sure as hell know about the trouble with keeping weight off, like Luka and Zion, do you sustain it over the course of the year? Like, that's the big question with some of these guys. And with Zion, hopefully, you know, I hope to God that guy stays healthy, because talking about fun players, Zion is one of the 10 funnest players in the whole NBA to watch when he's healthy. So, you know, hopefully he can stay healthy. Hopefully the Pelicans can be at least competitive, at least fun in the loaded Western Conference. But Kenny, appreciate you joining me today, man. We can't go another 5 years without you doing a pod with me, man.
Please,
this is really good. On, yeah. I'll definitely ask you on again this time this season. But sometimes I'm hesitant to ask because you're so busy. You're always doing so much. You're doing everything, it seems like. Please let people know where they can find your stuff this season.
Yeah, you can find me at Enjoy Basketball. We have a few different shows on our network that are, you know, doing some really cool things, as Kevin is too. Everybody's ramping up for this upcoming NBA season, and there's so much great content, you know, when it comes to the game of basketball. Hopefully, if you enjoyed this episode, you'll come watch some of mine. And I'm excited, Kevin. This was fun, and hopefully we can do the home and home, and you can come onto my show sometime throughout the season, and we can chat.
It's a yes. Let me know anytime, and I would love to, Kenny. Appreciate you joining me today, man. Have a good rest of your day.
You too.
All right, coming up, we're talking fantasy football with John Daigle. All right, let's talk some football. He does a Q&A every week on the Yahoo Fantasy Football channel. He works for Establish the Run, John Daigle. John, how you doing, man?
Doing great. We are getting ready to see two more football games before week 7. Nonetheless, lots of injury fallouts, lots of exciting moments from week 6 as well. So here to talk about it with you.
I'm excited to have you on, John. So you do great work at Establish the Run, and I've enjoyed watching your Q&As. They're very helpful. It's just packed with information. So I want to start off here with some general NFL. We can go into fantasy as well, but I'm a Patriots fan. Drake May, again, another monster week. Baker Mayfield, one of the plays of the entire season with his Houdini scramble escape. Jim Nance, the broadcast, was like, he has nothing there. Wait a minute. Yes, he does. Baker at his best with the scramble for the first down on a third down. It seems like when you look at NFL MVP odds right now, in the top six is both Baker Mayfield and Drake May. Kind of unbelievable that both of these guys are here at this point through 6 weeks of the season. Do you have any expectations that these guys are both going to stay in the race here, or do you think it's going to be some of the same old names that surpass them and lap them by the end of the year, John?
First of all, I am a longtime listener, first-time caller to you, Kevin, so excited to be joining you as well. And for Drake May, it's exciting just because it's the ascension we knew could happen, but falls so short so often. But even going back to last week, we got that massive divisional win in prime time over the Bills, which I feel like really helped start it. And also, when these MVP voters look at players of this caliber, what they do tend to look at is making the most of the slightest. And right now, given all the rotational changes for the Patriots, I do feel like Drake May is putting a lot on his shoulders single-handedly and carrying this team as they continue to figure out their wide receiver rotation. So I do think it continues. We have to remember, going back to his second to last year in North Carolina, he was a player who was touted as the potential number one overall draft pick. But then they lost guys like Javonte Williams, Dyami Brown. Whatever you think about those individuals, they are NFL players. And Drake May had to carry North Carolina his final year, slipped beyond Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels in the draft. But at the same time, we also are talking about a class. Think back to CJ Stroud, for example, where then everyone was trying to anoint him the MVP in his sophomore season and then shuffle up his class entirely, because people and players do tend to go backwards once the NFL gets more film on them. I do think we're at a situation now where people are trying to reshuffle last year's class, and they're debating whether Caleb Williams, Drake May, or Jaden Daniels should be the number one overall pick. I think that's a fair discussion, but Drake May is showing us the kind of caliber of player he's been for quite literally his entire career, going back to college. So super exciting. And when you talk about doing the most with the least, that brings into question Baker Mayfield, of course, who is my personal favorite for MVP right now, even losing Emeka Buka this past game, but it tending not to matter as they continue just dragging guys like Kate Otten, Tez Johnson, just finding them. And Baker Mayfield is carrying that offense as a whole.
I love the clip of Tez Johnson talking about how he thought the MVP chance were for him. Incredible.
What an innocent moment.
I know, exactly. But Baker, I mean, dude, my first NFL pod I did in August, I had Nate Tyson from Yahoo, and it was like questions for somebody getting back into the NFL, because the last time I'm watching football, Baker Mayfield was not so good. He was up and down, very inconsistent. Mm-hmm. Seemed like he might be a bit of a bust, and now he's in this spot with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, where they're losing key figures and it's not mattering. With Baker Mayfield, he's been the QB5 so far this fantasy season through 6 weeks. With him, do you expect some of these losses that the Bucs have experienced offensively to impact him at all? Or has he shown enough where you feel some confidence that Baker Mayfield's going to sustain this?
I keep trying to push back as a quote-unquote fantasy football stats guy. And I did this over the offseason where with a career high in fantasy points per game, touchdown rate, those numbers tend to regress year to year, especially touchdown rate. But it hasn't mattered so far for Baker Mayfield, who, simply put, is just a dog and keeps getting it done every single week. You would think some of the numbers regress and come back down to earth. Having said that, they are continuing to rotate players in and out so much so that they'll likely be getting back Mike Evans in the next couple of games. We have no idea on Chris Godwin's status. So it's a fluctuating passing line that's happening here. But right now, you can at least continue pinpointing Baker Mayfield as a low-end QB1 for fantasy, and just someone who is also continuing to add rushing yards. As you mentioned, a player who you see scrambling for first downs more. Like, that's who Baker Mayfield is now, just a guy who gets the job done. And to be fair, like the Giants we saw on Thursday night, football is just more fun when Baker Mayfield is good. So I'm all for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing to see the way these quarterbacks grow. And usually it happens over years for the growth to happen with Drake May. I'm going to always forever be in trouble with Patriots fans for saying he's not the guy during week one of the season, which was a horrible week one loss for the Patriots. Drake May looked the same as he did last year. And so Mike Vrabel looked like Gerard Mayo week one. And I was very unhappy week one. But since then, just the way he goes through his progression, the way he handles movement within the pocket, the accuracy of his throws, even in weeks two through four, he had some throws that were very interceptable balls that were simply dropped by the defense. It feels like week to week, Drake May's growth is so dramatic, and his chemistry with his new receivers is growing as well. With Drake May, at this point, I don't know if he's going to necessarily stay in the MVP race. Right now, he's sixth in odds on BetMGM. He's currently the QB7 in fantasy. Feels very sustainable in fantasy football. In the real world, I just think this amount of growth in year two is truly fascinating. It's unusual to see a guy grow this much in one individual season, in my opinion. Have you seen the same type of growth from Drake?
Definitely. I always like to look at what happens to quarterbacks whenever the pocket crumbles or when they're allowed to step back and actually analyze the field. And right now, from a clean pocket, which was the argument for Drake May in fantasy, for example, against the Saints, who are 31st in pressure rate, only ahead of the Panthers. But so far on the season, Drake May is one of only five quarterbacks completing 80% of his passes from a clean pocket, also seventh in yards per attempt. Just to have those two deep shots to Kayshon Boutte, again, as the team continues to try to rotate the receivers and find the best answer, DeMario Douglas is playing significantly less over the last month, but even then, against the Saints, didn't matter with that 50-yard shot touchdown. And then, of course, the stats look even better if Stephon Diggs is not called for a phantom OPI and he gets that 50-yard gain. So
two of his best throws were overturned, John. Two of his best throws in the day.
It's a game you should expect from Baker Mayfield against that type of from Drake May against that type of defense indoors. But again, this is the ascension of a second-year player. I don't think we should be surprised at all.
Yeah. Second point here: huge week for NFL injuries. We mentioned Emeka Ebuka earlier, losing him. Puka Nacua out as well. Garrett Wilson suffered an injury. Marvin Harrison Jr., Calvin Ridley. It's a long list. What would your advice be for fantasy owners who have some of these receivers on their squads and navigating the weeks ahead, especially with buys coming up as well?
We're getting to the point where it doesn't have to look pretty. You just have to get the job done. I think Kendrick Bourne was the best example of that this past week, where we were really just waiting for injury reports until Friday afternoon and then figuring it out from there. And now the past two games, someone like Kendrick Bourne, who is widely available on the waiver wire ahead of both week five and week six, 23% and 24% target shares, over 140 receiving yards in both games. That's what your lineup is most likely going to look like right now as you're continuing to sift through all the injuries. So I would say just keep your head down and keep on fighting through. The waiver wire exists, wherever you read for that reason. And so hopefully you can continue to find the correct answers at all your positions. But yes, also be ahead of this upcoming couple of weeks in week eight, because that's the first time we get six teams on bye. So we're already trying to look ahead right now to a couple of weeks in advance.
Yeah, and I think guys, I thought about picking up Kayshon Boutte on Sunday morning. He was a free agent in my fantasy league. I'm like, yeah, he's a Patriots receiver, 8% owned. Maybe I'll stash him on my bench for the 1 p.m. games, and he has a big game, and I'll try to trade him midweek to a team in need. I didn't do it. I regret it. But that does speak to an example of how sometimes even Sunday morning, not even on waivers, there could be a guy available that ends up having a big game, 26 points for Boutte in PPR leagues. Moving on to number three. So trade buy lows. The door has shut on some of the guys that you perhaps could have at least tried to buy low on a couple weeks ago. Brian Thomas, Ladd McConkey. Who's the current best buy low targets out there right now, John?
I got a few of them for you, and you have to step back and remember when we say buy low, it doesn't feel good. You're buying into a situation that there's a reason you can buy low. So if you have Brian Thomas, McConkey, as you mentioned, you did that at a terrible portion, something that did not feel good to take on, but you understood the risk and their ceiling. And to me, there are a couple players that encapsulate that right now. I want to start with Zay Flowers, because through the first month of the season, Lamar Jackson actually led the league with 9.5 yards per attempt, and the Ravens in that time were top three in both yards and EPA per play. Zay Flowers from Lamar Jackson this season, 7th in yards per route run, and has the league's 7th highest target share at 27.5%. They now, the Ravens, go on by, hopefully get completely healthy, and return as a 1-5 team. And remember, 1-5, only 4 teams with that such record in NFL history have gone on to make the playoffs. There's no more time to be cute for this elite Ravens offense when they're at full strength. It's now they have to come back out with all guns firing. And so I love Zay Flowers with the Ravens returning from bye in week 8. Another one I want to talk about is, again, because we're taking on the ugliness of a player's portion of their season, hoping that it becomes a ceiling option, that's Garrett Wilson. And right now, there's no offense that's worse to talk about than the Jets. Having said that, coming out of the international seas in London against one of the best teams in the league in Denver, just look ahead to this Jets schedule. Against the next 2 weeks, the Panthers and Bengals. That's a great start. But in 4 of the next 5, they also get the Ravens and the Patriots, which all 4 of those defenses I mentioned are 21st or lower in creating pressure. And when teams haven't pressured Justin Fields this year, he's actually 8th in completion rate and 11th in yards per attempt. Garrett Wilson has put up gaudy target shares, including 50% this past game against Denver. So as long as he's healthy, that's a player that Tuesday morning, once we get full clearance from his hip or ankle injury, whatever happened in London, that's someone I'm going to sneak in and try to lowball offers for. And then my final one, which is similar to on the Establish the Run podcast feed a couple weeks ago, I mentioned buying Travis Hunter just because we still have to zoom out. Everyone thinks that we're at an absolute portion of the season, and that's not the case. We're projecting weekly. And so with a guy like Travis Hunter, you just zoom out and think about the talent he's been from high school on. Literally the best player on the field wherever he stepped onto the field. And finally, in week 6 this past game against Seattle, we got a season-high 85% route participation for a top 10 NFL pick. That's great. You bought low for pennies and now you get him. A player I'm buying low for pennies in a similar fashion right now is Travion Henderson of your Patriots. Because he's being teetered as a player you should drop. And I don't agree with that at all. Just 4 fewer touches than Ramondre Stevenson since Antonio Gibson left for the year with a knee injury. And what's really happened behind the scenes is that Stevenson, the past couple of weeks, has out-carried Henderson 5-0 inside the 10-yard line as the team's touchdown back, let's say, short yardage option. But at the same time, Stevenson is still a player who tied for the league lead as position in fumbles in both 2024 and so far with Derrick Henry, oddly enough, this year. That usage could flip on a second for Travion Henderson. So that's a player with elite talent, both between the tackles and receiving game, that I now want to buy for his cheapest stock.
And when you talk about Travion Henderson, how much are you thinking about Vrabel's own history? Because there was once a time when he was a first-year head coach with the Titans, he played Deion Lewis ahead of Derrick Henry to begin that season with the Titans, and then it flipped. And Henry becomes the running back, both in fantasy and in reality, that we have long known. That could happen with Henderson as well. Are you thinking about that at all when it comes to your assessment of Henderson, or is it just purely about this Patriots situation right now?
Not thinking about it, honestly, just because when we're talking about season long, and a lot of people listening to this probably play in 10, 12 team leagues, certainly highly competitive, but you want to think about what you win when you win, and not worry about what we're paying. And right now, again, with Henderson, his stock being at its lowest point all season, what you are giving up is just negligent. You're most likely not even losing, even if Henderson becomes a player we do have to drop, just because everyone is willing to part with him for absolutely nothing. For a stash RB, for example, which is exactly what Henderson is, with one of the highest ceilings in fantasy football, if it all were to click. So I know what you're mentioning is the downside. I don't think of it like that. Because we're only trying to beat 9, 11 other people most of the time, 13 other individuals in our league. And if that's the case, I'm just absolutely willing to pay those pennies for a player that can be startable when it matters in mid-November on.
All right, moving on to the next question here. Number 4, has Rico Dowdle done enough to take the majority share of the snaps from Hubbard when he returns?
I would hope so, given his 239 yards.
Amazing.
His franchise record, by the way, in yards from scrimmage these past 2 weeks, which beats Christian McCaffrey of all players. Christian McCaffrey's previous franchise record that he set twice. It's now Rico Dowdle who can hang with the Raptors for the Carolina Panthers. To this point, Chuba Hubbard's peripherals had been the same. And Dave Canales had screamed this entire time that he wants to use a rotation of backs. Unfortunately, as great as Dowdle has been against a softer schedule and the Dolphins, Cowboys, and this upcoming week, the Jets, we still think that Canales wants to use a timeshare. But it's certainly the floor now is certainly 50-50. And perhaps Dowdle is still used in the passing game. We've seen Trevor Etienne, who was a receiving back coming out of college, even go overlooked in that department entirely as they leaned on Dowdle as their workhorse. But Hubbard last year, we saw a top 12 finish in points per game. Not that Canales is looking at that, but just one of the most efficient running backs in the entire league who still really wasn't used as a receiver. So maybe that's where Dowdle gets to moonlight while also still chipping away in carries. But I do think, unfortunately for both, it's going to be a 50-50 timeshare just because Hubbard also didn't do anything to lose his job. It's just that Dowdle has played so well, he has to continue sharing the load.
Now, you mentioned Travis Hunter as a potential buy low. In my league, a trade happened on Sunday morning where one owner sent Travis Hunter and Kyle Pitts to another team for Romeo Doubs and Rico Dowdle. An interesting trade. It feels like a bit of a sell high on Dowdle, a buy low on Travis Hunter. For that team that's receiving Hunter or losing Dowdle, do you see any probability there that ends up being a critical mistake selling on Dowdle at this point after now two big games for a buy low type of player?
You know, if anything, I think you could have sold Dowdle for much higher. But maybe the managers in your league are reasonable people. Most of the time, we don't deal with reasonable people. And if that's the case, like, that is the reasonable outlook, is that it's now a timeshare and it's going to resemble Seattle's backfield. And ask anyone who's starting Kenneth Walker or Zach Charbonnet right now, it's not fun at all. You have to start them. And you know what you're getting every single week, unless one falls forward inside the end zone. And unfortunately, if you start Walker, it's Charbonnet who's handling majority of the touches inside the 10-yard line. I think that's what Dowdle and Hubbard are about to look like for a worse and less efficient offense than the Seattle as well for this Panthers backfield. So Dowdle's someone I'm certainly looking to sell high and get off of before Hubbard returns. But I do think you can get a lot more than that trade.
Now, along those same lines, just sticking with the Panthers here, does that same logic apply to owners of Tet McMillan when Jalen Coker returns?
I don't know. Let's start here. I don't know when Jalen Coker return, and I think a lot of the time, the anomalies we think of when they return from injury, Puka Nacua a couple of years ago, Stephon Diggs so far this year, even though ask anyone who had Stephon Diggs the first 3 weeks, which I know seems like an aberration right now, but those first 3 weeks are ugly, so much so that everyone was asking if they should drop him. You had to really hold strong ahead of week four to keep him on your roster. It just takes a ramp-up time that everyone forgets about. So Jalen Coker, I still think we are minimum 2-3 weeks away from starting if he's active. And even then, we don't believe Bryce Young and this Panthers run-heavy offense can support two wide receivers. And so I think Tet McMillan is still fine. If anything, you should be encouraged about McMillan because to this point, everyone could tell you about his target share, his air yards. A player who profiled like Mike Evans out of college, and he'd really hoarded everything for Carolina's passing game. He goes back down, I should say, in quotes, to a 23.5% target share this past week against the Cowboys. But the great news, what I think you should be encouraged by, is that really for the first time ever, both of his touchdowns were inside the red zone. Whereas previously, they were just toiling away with guys like Mitchell Evans and Tommy Trimble inside the red zone instead. If that's what they're going to do moving forward, is use Tet McMillan like he should be used, we should again be encouraged and buy high on Tet McMillan because now we're getting that elite target share with actual upside because he can score touchdowns now. So I was actually encouraged by what I saw from McMillan against the Cowboys based on his red zone usage. And I'm not personally worried about Jalen Coker taking that over.
I think that's a good perspective coming from a McMillan owner on my team. Let's move on to number five here. On Sunday morning, there were reports that Hassan Haskins was probably going to be the lead back for the Chargers. That ended up being not true at all. Kamani Vidal ended up being the guy, 18 carries, 124 yards, three catches, four targets, scored a touchdown as well, and what was a win for the Chargers over the Dolphins. Vidal owned right now in only 28% of fantasy leagues. So still going to be a top waiver pickup entering week seven. What percentage of waiver money would you be willing to drop on Vidal this week?
Will and should be the top waiver pickup ahead of week seven. And a very explosive player that we thought could have a chance in place of J.K. Dobbins last year whenever he was injured the last month of the season for the Chargers. That team still instead leaned on Gus Edwards, and Hassan Haskins as an early down between the tackles bruiser really didn't get a chance. So the initial report on Sunday morning could have been true. It made sense that, oh, they used Gus Edwards last year in this place. Now they use Hassan Haskins. And it was instead Vidal who had 75% of the team's touches, an elite threshold to reach for any running back. Not only that, but 22% of his carries, 18 of them, went for 10-plus yards, which was the fifth highest rate in the league as well. So you're talking about an explosive workhorse who was also used primarily as their receiving back. That's someone we need to chase. And so I do think you should be willing to go up to 21%. And when I say 21%, most of the time, teams start with $100 of fab, and it's not repurchasable, even though you should be able to add more fab for whatever your league wants to. I hate that rule that we're stuck with only 100 to begin the year. Having said that, 21%, 21 remaining dollars of your fab, I think is a good number to start with, because there is always a chance that we could get the rug pulled for every Vidal player. Hassan Haskins' manager, for example, who went out of their way to roster him. There was also someone who went out of their way to roster Michael Carter, and then we saw overnight Bam Knight become the starter. Let's just say that is always in the range of outcomes, including for a player like Vidal. Maybe they just have a change of heart. Maybe game script gets out of the way and they want to lean on Haskins instead. But at least in terms of his week six usage, Vidal is an elite player playing with another MVP candidate that we didn't discuss, and Justin Herbert. So more than happy to spend 21 to 23 of my remaining fab for him and start him in week seven.
All right, last one here, number six. Rashee Rice managers are going to be rewarded here. Week seven, the Chiefs feel like they're starting to pick things up. 3-3 after a big Sunday Night Football win. It's feeling to me, John, like even though the Chiefs are only 3-3, the way in which they're performing right now, the argument is quite strong to say that they are the Super Bowl favorite in the AFC, even over the Buffalo Bills. Would you go that far at this point of the season, John?
Oh, I don't think it's even far. I went that far when they were 0-2. I think it's such a long it's such a long season that everyone forgets who the kings at the top of the mountain are. And the floor for the Chiefs, as long as Patrick Mahomes is healthy every year, is the Super Bowl. Their ceiling is winning the Super Bowl. Their floor is making it every single season. We're talking about Mahomes having it's so fun to see, too, because he's an alien. He's the best player on the field on every single field he walks on. We've known this now since he's entered the NFL, and he's really having a rejuvenation of his career. He talked about wanting to throw the ball more often and deeper this upcoming season when everyone is at full strength. And that's kind of exactly what's happening. Not only that, but also for fantasy, adding a career high in rushing points with his legs. We saw that on display on Sunday Night Football against the Lions whenever they dropped three or four safeties back. In the past, when Holmes would take what was given with him and just dump it off underneath onto one of those hot routes to Juju Smith-Schuster or Travis Kelce. Now he's also scrambling and running the ball. Has a top five scramble rate in the entire league. It's just adding an element to both his game and the Chiefs offense, the likes of which, quite honestly, we've never seen, given that he hasn't scrambled at this rate at his entire career. And so, yes, this is the Chiefs' kingdom. No pun intended. They're the team that everyone should be trying to topple. And until otherwise noted, Patrick Mahomes is the MVP that they should just name the award after and then give it to another player who's having a good year, because he is the most valuable player in the entire league. I do think it's a moment, though, since we're talking a little bit about fantasy football in between the actual football talk. I do think we should try to sell Xavier Worthy high right now, because we've seen in the past that Worthy is the inferior player to Rashee Rice. Just think about the minimal time they overlapped last year for the first couple of weeks, Rashee Rice had a 40% target share to Xavier Worthy's 19% when they shared the field. And also just remember that Rashee Rice was the wide receiver 3 last year before he got injured. He's the wide receiver 13 in fantasy since after Kansas City's bye when he was a rookie a couple years ago until the time he was injured last season. And then these two players were entirely different. Rice was 10th in yards per route run among all players in 2023 as a rookie. Worthy last year was 76th in yards per route run. Still good, but came on strong and developed normally as a rookie. Whereas Rice, when it was his first year, literally just played elite in the moments he got. And then once he became a starter, continued playing elite. And so right now is a situation where, as fun as it is to have all these players, I do think, like a Rico Dowdle trade, you could sell Worthy for quite high, understanding that Rashee Rice is the elite player who's coming back to soak up every single target from Mahomes. So that's the way I like to handle it. But regardless, the Chiefs are gunning, yes, again, for another Super Bowl.
It sure feels like it after that slow start. Winning 3 of their last 4 games, lost last week to Jacksonville, but it doesn't feel like it matters at this particular moment in time. Chiefs are serious, man. I mean, it's so much like the Warriors and the NBA, where it's like Mahomes is like the Stephen Curry, and as long as you have that guy, you have a chance. It's just you need to put the right pieces around that player. And Rashee Rice, man, you mentioned all those numbers, John. In my league, I believe the team that has Rice is 5-1. So huge reward for them to add Rashee Rice entering week 7 here. And I think with him, I'm curious. You said earlier about how when players come back from injury, in reference to Jalen Coker, it's not always an immediate impact. With Rashee Rice, do you expect him to be in your top 10 or top 20 receiver rankings as soon as he is back in week 7?
Absolutely. It's not only for the injuries as well, but remember, it's not an injury. Rashee Rice is coming back from a suspension.
Yes.
Same as Jordan Addison did. And now Addison has put up over 100 yards in both of his first starts. So we are not expecting any kind of tepid usage for Rice. We're expecting him to come right back out and be used as their leader in routes run from week 7 on.
What a great post there from Yahoo Fantasy Sports. It is true. He's ready to come back and dominate for fantasy teams. John, please let people know where they can find all your stuff.
EstablishTheRun.com is where I have my own personal waiver wire, not to mention weekly podcast on the Establish the Run feed. But then also, of course, the show that you watch every Friday. That's odd when you reached out to me because I'm talking to myself, answering chat questions. And I told you this behind the scenes, but you really just never know who's listening. Like, you forget, as naive as this sounds, you forget the reach that internet.com has. And so you just never know when a Kevin O'Connor is listening to your show. So Fridays, 5 p.m. Eastern, Yahoo Q&A every week.
I mean, I love those. I love those Q&As. It's fun. John, appreciate you joining me so much today, man. Thank you. Big thank you to Kenny and John for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and TJ for producing. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again on Thursday with another episode. Talk to you then.